I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s,
she looked like a million bucks,
scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Couric, and welcome to Election Week and a special bonus episode of Turnout. This past weekend, on the cusp of the 2020 presidential election, the New York Times published an unprecedented collection by the paper's opinion writers called What Have We Lost? 15 essays on what the past 4 years have cost America. From innocence, conservatism, allies, pride, and for my guest today, David Brooks, faith.
You talk about the floor of decency in your column. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, my view is that most, at least modern presidents or politicians, they understood there are certain standards of behavior you don't sink below. And you may not like George Bush or Barack Obama, but they tried to be decent and civil and not be, you know, talk about their hand size. And to me, the crucial moment I write about in that column was the second Republican debate, which was all the way back in 2015, the primaries.
I'm Jake Tapper. We're live at the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California for the main event.
And Donald Trump had gone after Carly Fiorina for the way she looks. And then he turned to Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, and he said,
I never attacked him on his look. And believe me, there's plenty of subject matter right there that I can tell you.
But Jake,
I want to give Mr. Trump,
that doesn't seem so shocking. Like, Trump has done way worse. But at the moment, I was like, what is going on here that we have a presidential candidate who talks, makes fun of people's looks? And it got worse. But once you fall through the floor, there's no bottom. And as a society, we're trying to find a bottom.
Well, I thought it was interesting. You write that people didn't seem to be morally repulsed by this. And there was no rise up against this kind of behavior. Peter Baker and I talked about how fragile these norms are, and they really require the key players in the system to adhere to them. And why do you think that that became acceptable and even praised in some quarters, that kind of language, that kind of derision?
I think first, we've gotten used to a certain, we watch enough reality TV, we get used to a certain level of crassness. Second, people have such low expectations of their politicians that they don't expect anything. And third, a lot of people feel the elites of society are trying to control their thought and speech with political correctness codes. And if somebody's going to break through those codes, they're like, yeah, I'm for that. And so I'd say those three things are the main drivers.
Let's talk about elites versus everyone else. You know, you talk about these two armies, and one is sort of college educated, you know, think of themselves as worldly and sophisticated. The other people are less perhaps educated, have been left out of the American dream in many ways. And there are two sides in polarization. How do we bring them together, and what could each side do better?
Well, first, we have a way to do this. It's called contact theory. You just bring people into contact with each other. And I got the 2016 election way wrong. And so I spent the next 4 years up until COVID going about 35 or 40 states a year, just really traveling and being with other people would call it going to a bar. I call it reporting. And so I'd sit in a bar and just talk to people and or breakfast diner. And I learned so much. I learned that people who voted for Trump, they're not all racists. There's a lot of complicated reasons people voted for that guy and still vote for that guy. I ran into a guy in South Dakota who said the best day of my life, he was like 70, was 35 years ago. I got laid off at my job because I didn't have the skills and I thought I would just slip out. And I opened my office door and there were two rows of people, 3,500 people, the whole plant's workforce with a double rows. And he walked between them from his office door to his car door in the parking lot as they applauded and cheered him as he went. And he said, that was my best job. That was the best day of my life. Every job I've had since is worse. And so I need a change. And so he was going to vote for Donald Trump, and everybody he knew was going to vote for Donald Trump. The communities are crumbling. I would say that two things that each side can do. First, the supporters of Trump can insist on honesty. You know, we just got to have rules of honesty. Second, those of us in the more college-educated class, we have to persist in our efforts to get to know those people. 4 years ago, we all read J.D. Vance's book and thought, oh, I'm going to try to get to know them. And then we sort of stopped. And we often condescend, and I'll say this as a media person, like you, obviously, you know, of the mainstream media organizations, of the 5,000 people in them, how many of them are Trump supporters? Very, very few. And if you tell 40% of the country your voice isn't worth hearing, well, they're going to react badly. And so we need to do a better job of integration and contact.
How do you do that, though, when you say that he's busted through the floor of decency? I mean, it's a real conundrum, I think, for people, because they want to be fair, and yet someone who repeatedly lies and seems to have crashed through that floor, how do you stand up to that? So that's a very difficult and tricky thing to navigate, is it not?
Yeah, and even, you know, I've been on shows where we've had Trump supporters, and they haven't behaved in a professional manner. So, I mean, we do have standards of for our profession. So that is a challenge. Eventually, you find some. But if breaking the norm is part of being a Trump supporter, then how do you work and collaborate? That is a genuine problem. But hopefully, if Trump loses, we can have Trumpism without Trump. That the ideas that he could have created an administration out of how to help rural America, how to help industrial America. We can have people who champion those ideas without the norm-breaking behavior of Donald Trump.
Do you think if elected, Joe Biden will champion those ideas and reach out to those communities? Because it seems that they feel, and I think legitimately, that they're not being heard or valued.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, and fortuitously, he's, I think, the right man for this moment because he comes from Scranton. Condescension is not a note I've ever seen him hit. He doesn't do condescension. And so I think he fits in naturally and has a natural rapport with people in working class communities that even Barack Obama did not have. And so I think he's well fit for this moment. Somebody just sent me a new ad he's done that Bruce Springsteen narrates to his song, My Hometown. And it's about a guy from Scranton. And I do think he's rooted in that, these kind of small city, rural America, and has an agenda, which if he's smart, if he focuses an agenda that addresses deindustrialization, all the places that have hurt because mills closed, then you particularly hit two communities and you hit them at the same time with the same program, African Americans and rural whites. And to have a program that unites those two groups and helps them would be, I think, a great thing for this country.
I also think if he could focus on retraining, you know, we've heard a lot about the transition from fossil fuels to, you know, green energy. And I think that terrifies people who think it means they're going to lose their job. And I have never understood why such a small percentage of GDP is really focused on retraining individuals for the jobs of the future.
You know, or at least getting us out of the model where you have to go to college to have a good job. Like, community college or apprenticeship programs are just a more effective way to give people the skills they need to succeed. They, you know, we send so many people to college and like 25% or 30% of them get through. And so we have a system that's failing 70% of the people. How can we stick with that?
Not to mention the exorbitant cost of college, right, which just does not seem to be sustainable to me.
Right, that's for sure. And colleges are now suffering. I don't know what's going to happen to higher ed in the years ahead.
Let's talk about the crisis of legitimacy. You cite a survey that says in 1997, 64% of Americans had a good or great deal of trust in the wisdom of their fellow Americans. Today, it's only a third.
Right.
What happened?
People took a look at each other's voting behaviors and they said, oh, those people are not only wrong, they're crazy or they're evil. And so they lost faith in each other. To me, the scariest statistic is trust in each other. Two generations ago, if you ask people, are your neighbors trustworthy? 60% say yes. Now it's only 33%, and only 19% of millennial and Gen Z. The younger you go, the more distrusting people are because they've been betrayed by experience. And so when a church loses faith in God, the church collapses. When a nation loses faith in each other, the nation collapses. And somehow restoring trust in each other is like the elemental task. Joe Biden can win, but if we don't trust in our society, if we can't work together, we're still in deep trouble.
We'll be back right after this short break.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation,
I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's return to this special bonus episode of Turnout with my guest, New York Times columnist David Brooks.
Why is this election such a pivotal moment in our nation's history?
I think we're at one of those moral convulsion moments that happens about every 60 years. From the 1770s, we had one, the 1830s, Andrew Jackson, the 1890s, Progressive Era, 1960s. The whole culture just suddenly shifts. You get a moment where you get a lot of indignation. People are disgusted with the state of society. A new generation comes on the scene, new communications technology, and suddenly the whole country just shifts ideas and it shifts culture. And I think we're at one of those inflection points where we either decide to be a diverse society or not. We either decide to be an equal society or not. And so these elemental questions are on the table.
You have said this is the result of 50 years of social decay. How so?
Well, if you look at society in the 1950s, we had a lot of problems. We had racism, we had sexism, we had a lot of anti-Semitism, but we did have a lot of cohesion. We had very low income inequality. We had very low political polarization. We had a lot of people really active in their communities, a lot of people with stable emotional bases. And over the last 50 years, we've had a culture of me, a culture of I want to be free to be myself. And that's been great. And we've made a lot of progress, especially on race and gender and other issues. But we've torn apart the connections between people. And so now you have more loneliness, more distrust, more isolation, more suicide rates, a third more depression. And so people, when you make them feel lonely and alienated, they're going to do what their evolutionary roots tell them to do. They're going to revert to tribe. And they've reverted to political tribes. And now we don't really see issues. We just say, what army am I part of? And that's just been a horrible thing for our country.
And let's talk about that some more, David. So our basic sense of belonging has now translated into our political ideology and identity. Yeah. And why is that so damaging for our society?
Because it's asking more of politics than politics can bear. Politics at its best is a competition between partial truths. Republicans believe in freedom, Democrats believe in equality, and we need to somehow find balance between those two things. And it's about policies. It's about designing a healthcare system that'll actually work for people. But we've turned it into our ethnicity. My ethnicity is being a Republican or a Democrat. It's not being Polish American or Italian American or somebody from Dallas or a member of this church. It's politics. And when you turn politics into your ethnicity, then any compromise is dishonor. You're dishonoring your ethnicity. And so when you ask so much of politics, you turn politics into this war of all against all, where there's no compromise. And then it's not really that satisfying. If you devote yourself to your community and your faith and your family, these are actually emotionally satisfying things.
Politics, the things that are bringing us together are the things that we hate, not the things that we love.
Yeah, and it's important to make the distinction between tribalism and community. And community is mutual love of a thing. Tribalism is mutual hate of another. And so it feels at first like community, but it's more like an addiction than an actual relationship.
What can be done about this loneliness and isolation that has prompted people to take these sides or join these armies?
Yeah, well, in my view, it would help if we weren't being ripped apart on a day-to-day basis from the top of our society. So that answer is political. But to me, this kind of isolation and loneliness can only be helped by at local level, at relationships, and by forming groups and getting active in groups, active in community organizations, active in neighborhood organizations. You know, I became a member of an extended group about 6 years ago, 40 kids from D.C. who were like 20, and about 8 of us who are older. And we had dinner every Thursday night for 5 years. And we really got in each other's business and we learned to trust one another. And we became sort of a chosen family, a forged family. And that's how I found community. And I think everybody tries to find something like that.
Do you think that the pandemic in some ways has added fuel to this partisan fire because people don't have enough to do and enough places to go and enough activities to participate in? It's increased the polarization.
Yeah, I've super felt that we underestimate the emotional toll this has taken on us. Like just the pleasure of going to a club and watching music. A lot of pleasures have suddenly denied us. And then we're stuck looking at each other, the Twitter version of each other, not the real version of each other. And so you've seen this shocking rise in depression. There was a poll out about the middle of this year where they asked people, young adults, have you contemplated suicide in the last 30 days? And like a third had. And so we're just living at a time of tremendous just emotional stress. And it's showing up in all sorts of ways, especially in politics.
Can we talk about identity politics and how that has prohibited both a conversation about policy that allows for nuance and an environment that also allows for compromise?
Yeah. I mean, if your identity is at stake in your policy positions, then you feel your identity threatened at every moment and you can't compromise. And so if your identity is based somewhere else, then you're not at stake. You're not at risk of annihilation. The other thing that I think has been worrying recently, we're being not very cheerful, but we'll be cheerful, is just the idea that we can't really communicate with each other. I can never really understand your experience, and you can never really understand mine. We can't understand each other across difference. And I have great faith in reciprocal dialogue and conversation, in what you've spent your career doing, interviewing people. When I was on this trip to understand the world and Trump voters, I really became convinced the interview, it's such a blessing in our profession. The interview is what helps us make contact with each other and learn about each other. And if we don't do that, and a lot of people don't, then you just don't know. You just don't know. And you can do all the academic sociological data you want, but if you don't do the interview, you don't know.
And it's all punditry now. It's all commentary and punditry. And it distresses me that people aren't going out and talking to regular people. I mean, when is the last time you saw that except for the pro forma, you know, diner conversation during the primaries?
Right. No, I agree. But don't knock punditry, it's a living. I wrote 16 columns saying, don't worry, in 2015, don't worry, Donald Trump will never get the Republican nomination. And at the time, I was working for the New York Times, living in Washington, and teaching at Yale. So I was in the Acela my whole life. So like, how could I get out of touch with America with those three things? So I had to break out and spend time with people. And now I have a fair number of friends and even close family members who are supporting Donald Trump. And it's been useful because so many of them are super confident he's going to win, 100% sure. But it's just been useful to hear the arguments, hear the points of view, which are not the simple, obvious ones that we assign to those people.
When we come back, what are we going to do with all this anger we have?
I'm Elia Kani, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation, I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk about wokeness, because I like this quote. You say it's partly about fighting oppression, but it's also become a status symbol. It's showing people that you are so intellectually evolved that you can use words like intersectionality, decolonizing, and cultural appropriation. Political correctness is not just a means for the less privileged to set standards of behavior. It is sometimes the way people with cultural power push others around. How can the left listen to the silent majority rather than patronize them? How do we find a national discourse?
Yeah, I mean, it's people take advantage of the power they have. And wokeness is a movement that emerged out of the universities. And it comes thick with university jargon. It comes thick with the belief that all words are power. And you can't have a conversation, I'm just asserting my power with my words. And therefore, my words need to be controlled. And that, to me, is wrong. Words are not power. Words are mutual explorations to find, you know, ways to live together and be friends. And so the impulse to censor words and use the power of your cultural position to silence others is not only in the university, it's not only in the media, it's widespread. There was a study, 62% of Americans say they're afraid to state their political opinions for fear that other people will shout them down. That's a lot of people. That's the majority of Americans who are afraid to be honest. And so my friends and I, I'm a New York Times columnist. I'm in the precincts of cultural power. And a lot of people in those precincts don't appreciate how much power they have and how, like all power, it can corrupt you and you can abuse it. And we abuse it when we try to use it to shout down and silence others.
But don't you think the right wing is just as guilty? I mean, I don't see many people going on Fox feeling comfortable expressing a different point of view.
Oh, no, there's super right wing wokeness just as well. Literally, people get canceled on the right for not totally being with Donald Trump, for having some opinion, or, you know, for being for gay marriage. I mean, there's wherever these days there's wokeness, or whether there's political extremism, there's intolerance of difference. And I do think there's wokeness on the right just as much as on the left.
I also am concerned that people can have a nuanced position, that they can't support Black Lives Matter and want to get to the root of systemic racism, but also appreciate what good police officers do, and yet also see the need for police reform. It seems to me you have to pick one side or the other when, you know, all things may be true.
Yeah, and I've admired Joe Biden for this. for saying, yes, we have systemic racism, but America is still a very lovely country. Yes, we want to, Black Lives Matter, but we also need some law and order. So these are false binaries, and I think he's done a good job. There was a student group at University of Wisconsin this week who, I think they took down a statue of Abraham Lincoln, or they did something to cancel Abraham Lincoln. And like, you can think two things at once about Lincoln. One, by our standards, his views on race were not evolved, not correct. But you can also realize the guy gave his life to end slavery. So he did just tremendous good in, over the course of his life. And you should be able to have both those things in your mind at the same time.
And the same thing is happening to Thomas Jefferson, who established my alma mater, the University of Virginia. There's a culture war of sorts erupting there, with people feeling like he should not be sort of the patron saint of the university, somebody to be idolized. And there are those who say, you know, don't mess with Jefferson.
Right. Yeah, my rule on that is we should cancel somebody if the main thing they're known for is disgraceful. So at Yale, there was a Calhoun College named after John Calhoun.
I did a whole thing on this, and that was the determination. What is the primary accomplishment of that individual? And for John C. Calhoun, it really was perpetuating slavery.
Right. And Jefferson is writing the Declaration of Independence, being president. And the difficult case is Washington and Lee University. You know,
where my late Robert husband Lee came. Went.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, very fine school. I've been there many times. I love that place. My view is Washington Lee became Washington Lee because Robert E. Lee became president of the college after the Civil War. So maybe they're celebrating him for that. But other things like at Virginia Military Institute right next door, they just took down a statue of Stonewall Jackson. And maybe that's legit. It's tough for them because he was the great hero and he led the students at VMI out to battle. But maybe that stuff is legit. My view is the statues, the Confederate statues, some of them should come down, but mostly we should just put up other statues, statues that memorialize those who were victims of lynching, who led the fight for Reconstruction, for abolition, for civil rights. I'd love to see them contextualized a little more than torn down.
I know that's one option. I sort of feel that they should be taken down if they're in a prominent position, because to me, statues in public spaces telegraph the values of that community. So I think it's kind of hard to have both, but I take your point because I know some people feel that way. I think they should belong in museums and be explained as a really critical part of our history, but not necessarily as the centerpiece of a community.
Yeah, I see that. Where I live in Washington, D.C., I'm right near a thing called Lincoln Park. And there's a statue which was put up by former slaves of Lincoln, toward Lincoln, in homage of him. But it's him standing over a kneeling African-American slave who's breaking free. The first time I saw that, I thought, what is that doing there? Like, why is the African-American guy kneeling in Lincoln's feet? But it was put up by, and I've had long debates with people in the park about that statue. And at first I thought, well, it was a historical moment. Frederick Douglass did a very famous speech right there. But I think it should probably go in a museum, maybe.
Your colleague Maureen Dowd wrote about how it's exhausting to be this outraged all the time. And we do seem to be in a permanent state of anger and outrage, lashing out at people who probably have much more in common with us than we realize. And you say permanent indignation is not a healthy emotional state. How do we de-escalate this anger, and how do we prevent this from being our default emotion? Because it seems like it's been this way for quite a while now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if Biden wins, he's just less outrageous than Donald Trump, whatever you think of his views. And what really struck me is, remember that a couple of weeks ago, they both had town halls at the same time.
Yes.
And you knew going in that Biden's was going to be more boring than Trump's, and indeed it was. But more people watch Biden's than watch Trump's. And that said to me that people are ready for a little normal political discussion. And I do think, A, if Biden wins, we won't have to think about the presidency all the time. And B, frankly, for a lot of us, it's easy clickbait to just outrage about Trump all the time. And maybe politics will be less central and we can go, I prefer writing about culture than I do to politics. But I can't do that now because people only read one subject, which is politics. So I'd love to be able to go back and write about cultural stuff and moral stuff and emotional stuff. And I think we would all just, blood pressure would just go down.
I thought we could talk a little bit about weavers and what you're doing with that.
Yeah, no, weavers are people who are at the local level building community. That one of them, for example, is a guy, Pancho Aguiles, who he takes undocumented immigrants who've broken their backs and been paralyzed by construction accidents. And he gives them wheelchairs and diapers and catheters so they can lead lives with dignity. And then he organizes them. They all become social workers. So you'll be in a neighborhood and 50 Latino guys in wheelchairs will roll in your neighborhood to do good work for you. And so those people are everywhere. We, you know, at the Weave Project, we go around the country. We land in a little town, McCook, Nebraska, Wilkes, North Carolina. And we say, who's trusted here? And immediately we find 75 people who are just love their town. And they want to serve it, and they do. And what we at Weave do is we try to lift them up, maybe give them some resources, connect them with each other, make them more powerful figures in our society so we can all sort of copy them a little.
David, how can Trump supporters and Biden supporters learn to respect one another?
Yeah, repeating back to each other what we believe. Like, here's why, tell me if I'm right, here's why I think you believe what you believe. And just having a conversation that way. People basically want respect, and a lot of people feel invisible. When I would go to the Midwest years ago, once a week I'd hear, oh, you guys regard this as flyover country. And then 2 years ago, I heard that 8 times a day. People just don't feel seen. They feel they're ignored and looked down upon. And if I think you show respect to Trump voters and who follow you. And that's the first step, is showing basic respect. And of course, we're going to disagree. That's called democracy. But disagreeing with a show of affection and respect, and with a sense that we all do love the same country. And I think a lot of people who are voting for Trump are afraid that we don't all love the same country. We don't all love our country. And some people just want to run it down and change it. And I think Biden, again, has done a good job of saying, hey, I love America. This is the America. This is my country. And if we have that mutual affection, then we have something in common.
Hey, listeners, I'll be back in just a few days with my post-election episode of Turnout. In the meantime, I'd love to hear your voting story, whether you voted early in person, sent in your mail-in ballot, or are planning to vote on Election Day. Tell me what your experience was like and how it felt, good or bad. You can call 844-479-7883 and leave your name in a short 30-second message, and we may share it on an upcoming episode. Again, that number is 844-479-7883. Happy voting, everyone. Turnout is a production of iHeartMedia and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are Katie Couric and Courtney Litz. Supervising producer is Lauren Hansen. Associate producers, Derek Clements, Eliza Costas, and Emily Pinto. Editing by Derek Clements and Lauren Hansen. Mixing by Derek Clements. Our researcher is Gabriel Luzer. And special thanks to my right-hand woman, Adriana Fazio. You can follow me in all my election coverage at Katie Couric. Meanwhile, yes, I'm Katie Couric. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. We'll see you next time.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.